The Nail in the Coffin!
Welcome to The Nail. I'm Tom. He's Travis. We're part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. And Trav, how about the Cleveland Browns?
I tell you what, I think if you listened to us last week, you'd probably, and I feel like kind of a, fucking loser now, because last week I was not the most optimistic guy. I was hopeful, but I don't think I had very high expectations. It was right around the time we found out about Stefanski being out. And, you know, we had a whole bunch of guys that weren't going to be playing. And I was, you know, somewhat resolved to the fact that our season was over and it was a successful season, but it was probably done. And can't begin to express how happy I am that I was completely and utterly wrong about that.
I had in mind a path to victory for the Browns. Never in my wildest dreams did it involve anything remotely close to what we saw in that first quarter. I was taking a walk around the block on Sunday afternoon, and I actually bumped into my dad. He lives a few streets over from me, and he was out for a walk too. And he's like, well, what do you think about tonight? And I'm like, just don't get knocked out in the first 10 minutes like what happened the last time the Browns played in Pittsburgh. And instead, lo and behold, it was a complete role reversal.
We were the Mike Tyson in this scenario.
That's right. And I'm going to tell you, like, NFL Network had a replay of the game. I think it was last night. I don't know, but I'm flipping through the channels and I saw that. That first quarter is going to be my go-to thing to watch when I'm having a bad day for the foreseeable future. That just was everything you could ever want to see in your team delivering in a high-profile situation. Just spectacular. And what was really fun was, I think it was after like either the first or second touchdown, Al Michaels was like, this is like 18 years of frustration all being, you know, all pent up and all being let out at once. And like watching it back, I'm like, oh, we're just getting started. Like, we got a long way to go here, boys.
So I have a confession to make. So the game, the kickoff was at 8:15, right? And
yep,
I've spent my entire adult life knowing the kickoff's at 8:15, this is not really going to be till about 8:19, 8:21, somewhere in there. So my wife and I were finishing a show that stopped right at 8:15. I flipped it over. They had scored a touchdown, and I'm looking around like, what the fuck's going on here? I'm completely confused. No clue what's going on. So I didn't even see the first touchdown. And luckily, there was plenty more for me to see after that. I think my favorite sort of exchange was, I think it was Michael said, you know, if you hadn't watched football in a long time, you weren't really familiar with the state of the NFL and you turn this on, you'd be really confused. And Collinsworth said, yeah, if you were really familiar with the state of the NFL, you'd be really confused. I was like, yeah, that kind of captures it.
Oh man. Yeah. It was something else. And it was jarring to me. You know, we did talk about last week about just, you know, as we're trying to put a positive outlook on this season in general and just kind of the infrastructure that's been put into place and, you know, a good outlook for the future. And one of the big things that we were thinking about was just, you know, what Kevin Stefanski has been able to build and, you know, and just, you know, kind of putting a system in place, having everybody pulling in the same direction, having everybody on the same page. And, you know, we saw that on Sunday night. I mean, everything that you could hope for in terms of looking organized, you know, dealing with curveballs. I mean, you had already Michael Dunn was playing offensive line, which was a desperation situation to begin with. And, you know, he played a great game up until the point he got hurt. And then what did Baker call him? A guy named Blake I met in the locker room.
A guy named Blake. All-time line. I watched after the game. I was like, in a lot of cases, it would be kind of like, that's the kind of thing that Browns fans would be in the past. Browns fans would be saying to each other, like, yeah, we're playing some guy named Blake out here on the offensive line. And somehow with this team, it worked. It's just a confluence of things where everything seemed to go right. They had a perfect game plan drawn up. I think the fact that they've been doing this, they've been working in this sort of gray area all year of like uncertainty and not really knowing what's going on, I have to think it put them in a unique position to handle this well. Cause I think the way that Stefanski has been coaching all year, the way they've been doing so many of their meetings remotely anyways, and they've been sort of detached from each other in a way, made all the chaos of last week not really as chaotic as it probably would have been otherwise.
You know, the other thing, I agree with everything you just said, but I was going to say the other thing that really jumped out at me in that first quarter was the Browns completely blew the Steelers off the ball both ways. They dominated the trenches in a way that I've never seen a Browns team handle the Steelers before. I mean, Kareem Hunt was running through people. I somebody on Twitter, I can't remember who it was, he's a violent runner. And it was a perfect description. I think I texted you and John. I said, he just looks like an absolute nightmare to tackle. And you just watch like Treader, you know, pancake blocking, you know, I think it was either the first touchdown for Kareem or the second one where I think it was the second one where, you know, Kareem Hunt's running towards like that near sideline and Treader like pulls and it goes left and had the block that sprung the whole thing open and just, you know, hammered the dude that he was blocking. And, you know, going the other way in that first quarter when it was still a game, Pittsburgh had a 3rd-and-1 situation and they handed off to their fullback. And Larry Ogunjobi was already in the backfield completely pushing back their interior, you know, offensive line and completely blowing that play up. And the Browns just looked more physical. They looked more aggressive. I know you didn't see that first play when Pouncey snapped the ball over Roethlisberger's head. But there's a still frame of that where, you know, Roethlisberger and James Conner were like right by the ball and there were no Browns within like 5 or 6 yards. And it's like, if you just look at that, it's like, how in the hell are the Browns going to end up with this? And those guys were just like so flat footed and passive. And, you know, the Browns just, you know, came out like their hair was on fire. And it was wild to watch.
Yeah, it was. I missed the first play in real time. I've obviously since watched it, but that first quarter, it's crazy that they were up 28-0, right? So that in and of itself is wild. But yeah, the way that they were immensely better in every facet of the game. They were more physical. They were more disciplined. They executed a million times better. Everything about it was exactly what you wanted to see. If they'd played that way for, you know, a small stretch of the game, you'd be pretty happy with the effort, right? You'd be like, okay, they did plenty. You know, they gave themselves a damn good chance, and it's hard to do that for an entire game. We saw that like the defense wasn't exactly great after that, but the offense didn't slow down. The offense kept executing. There were a couple times I know they got in the red zone and had to settle for field goals, but, They didn't get content at 28-0. It was
defense was on the field for a long time.
That's fair.
Only drawback of, you know, scoring an avalanche of 28 points in no time at all is that your offense is not on the field at all and your defense is. So
that's what they call one of those good problems.
That's it. That is a very first world problem. Two things kind of stood out to me in the second half, and I'm sure that, you know, this has been broken down ad nauseum elsewhere. The decision by the Steelers to punt to start the fourth quarter, I was shocked because the Browns surrender defense. That's exactly cowardly. What it was.
Cowardly.
I could not for the life of me understand that decision given the momentum in that game, in that situation. And I felt like once that happened, it completely flipped the script on that game because the Browns, it was starting to get interesting a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, as Browns fans, we're getting a little nervous just because we're used to it and we've seen it before. But yeah, that was, you knew they didn't believe that they were going to win at that point.
Right. And then the other one, I think the Browns were up 13 in the fourth quarter and they were in the red zone. And there was that pass on third and goal. Who did it go to in the end zone? Hooper? It was one of the tight ends. And it, you know, the defender obstructed his vision a little bit and it like hit him in the hands and he dropped it.
Yeah.
It was Hooper. And yeah, I said it right at the time. I'm like, I hope to God that isn't like the Northcutt 2.0 moment. You know, it's like you had a chance to put the game away with one more catch. But, you know, to their credit, Parkey made a field goal. And I think after that was the Taki Taki interception and, you know, another field goal. And that was it. So, yeah, that, you know, the Browns handled their business.
Tight end for Ohio State fans may remember that it could have potentially been like the Ryan Hamby play. I don't know how well you remember Ryan Hamby in 05.
That was the Texas game in 05, yeah.
It had that sort of feel to it at the time. But I'll tell you what, there was another time I was watching the Titans-Ravens game. And I was texting with a few of my other friends while the game was going on. And there was a point in the game where there was a similarly cowardly punt from Vrabel. And there was a couple plays from Harbaugh. And I said to my friends, I said, this sounds really weird to say, I'll take Stefanski over any of these guys. I'll take him over Tomlin. I'll take him over Harbaugh. I'll take him over Vrabel. And these are guys that are, you know, many people have been saying, you know, top five type coaches in the league. I'll take where we're at over any of them, not just from like a roster standpoint. And that's another thing we probably need to talk about is it's not just like execution and coaching. This is the first time in a long time that, talent wise, we match up with Pittsburgh. We match up with them. Yeah. Every, you know, as much as you can look in and say, you know, there was a lot of injuries and stuff like that. It's not one of those seasons. Like there was a few years ago where we steamrolled Pittsburgh and it was like this fluky game and they were clearly still the better team. And that's happened a couple times, right? We're roster wise, we're right there with anybody. And we also happen to have a damn good coach to go with it.
Oh, what a fun situation to be in. Let's talk about what's coming up this Sunday.
You don't really
need
to because I've heard that we're going to get clapped this week. Is that what I've heard?
That's the word on the street.
From people that are sitting at home. You'd think a guy that played at Notre Dame would be a little more used to losing. But it's bizarre to me that they're still running their mouths so much, especially a guy who is 1-2 against the Browns. Chase Claypool felt it necessary to take another shot at the Browns, in his words, because he thought that the Browns disrespected Juju, who unquestionably disrespected the Browns first. I don't know. It's a weird – I honestly don't really care that much because my team's still playing, and I'd rather talk about my team than this guy who's sitting at home for the Steelers. But it was kind of a funny sort of talking point from today.
He's got time. we'll leave it at that. It is what it is there.
It feels very Michigan-y. Like Michigan for all these years has been losing to Ohio State and then living vicariously through better teams that happen to beat Ohio State. You know, they were rooting for Clemson last year and they were huge Alabama fans on Monday. Your team isn't getting it done and you have to root for someone else to beat your rival. I'm glad we're not in that position for once.
No, we're not. Our team's still playing. And they got a tall order coming up on Sunday. The defending Super Bowl champion Chiefs. Browns are a sizable underdog, even though they're getting back several key pieces. Who were out this past weekend.
They're pretty damn close to full strength, right?
As close as they're going to get this year,
Has Betonio been cleared officially?
As of the time we're recording this, I don't think he has,
but I think he's expected to.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've not heard anything that would indicate that that's not going to happen. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. It's going to be a tall order. This is a different kind of game. I just because, you know, there's a lot of familiarity between the Browns and the Steelers. There's a lot of history between the Browns and the Steelers, and just storylines everywhere. And, you know, you're going into Kansas City. These two teams, the Browns and the Chiefs, they've really not crossed paths a whole lot. I think there was the game, what was it, 2 years ago? I think they played the week after Hugh Jackson got fired. I think, I'm pretty sure that was like the first game that Greg was the interim coach. Before that, I mean, there was like a Jerome Harrison game, what, 10 years ago? I can remember back in 1989, I went to the old stadium and saw the Browns and Chiefs play to a 10-10 tie. Beyond that, not a ton. So, I don't know. This will be interesting. I mean, I'm fine with the Browns being a sizable underdog here. They probably should be.
It was up to 10, I think, right?
Yeah, that's fine.
That's a lot of points in the playoffs.
It is. And I'll tell you, you know, the Chiefs offense is, you know, gets a lot of love. And they should. I mean, Pat Mahomes does stuff. I mean, and no-look passes and everything else. And you can certainly see a script for how this could go horribly wrong for the Browns here. You know, between Mahomes, Kelce, you know, their wide receivers, you know, against the Browns secondary, that you know, that could get kind of nerve-wracking. However, I will also say, if you're a Chiefs fan right now, I would also be paying attention to the Browns offense. I think we've got a hell of an offense too. And you know, I think we've actually put up more 40-point games this year than Kansas City has. So
Kansas City's been in a lot of tight games this year. They got a lot of like single possession wins, and yeah, they win those games, and that's, you know, credit to them for that. But
question is, are they just kind of keeping a few clubs in the bag, or are they, you know, not going full throttle, kind of biding their time until they flip the switch for the playoffs? You know, we saw the Cavs do that in the NBA playoffs for however many years. NFL's a little bit different animal. Yeah, I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, it's possible. I think we've been texting back and forth. I think, obviously, Kansas City's the favorite. They deserve to be a decent favorite, right? But I don't think it's as, and I think you agree with this, I don't think it's as dire or as big of a long shot as many are sort of making it out to be. I think Kansas City's defense is, there's opportunities there that you can exploit, right? And I think, I don't know, I'm sort of hearing different things and about what people think we should do and things like that. But I think overall, there is a path. Like you mentioned against Pittsburgh, there was an avenue to victory there. Now, obviously, they sort of blew that open, and it was a little more convincing than maybe we expected it to be. But there was still a path that needed to be followed. And I think that exists against Kansas City, too. That doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be able to do it. It's not like, not that they should be the favorites or anything like that, but the way they're playing right now, I mean, I think you'd be foolish to think they have no chance.
Yeah. And, you know, a couple things, just notes here that I've been kind of reading up on. I think Andy Reid is now 19-3 coming off a bye. And I think he's 5-2 in his first playoff games when they have a bye in the first round. So obviously he does a very good job of preparing his teams when he's got a little extra time. Flip side of that, however, is teams that are that have a week off in the playoffs, they get a bye, and they also rested their starters in the final week of the regular season, which Kansas City did. Those teams have a penchant for starting very slowly on offense and having very low scoring first quarters. So you would think, you know, it's obviously unrealistic to expect the Browns to hang 28 on somebody in the first quarter again. But if you want to start talking past the victory, the Browns jumping out early certainly is it that seems like if they're going to, you know, get this done and pull off another upset, that would probably be the way it has to happen.
Yeah. And I mean, I think ultimately what we're getting at is they shouldn't be the favorite, but I think seeing a number like 10 out there is a little bit high. I think it's maybe a lot bit high, but I don't think it's indicative of or fair to say that they're that big of an underdog. That's a lot of points in the NFL, especially in the playoffs. They're an underdog for sure, and maybe it's because Kansas City scores so much. Like it could be one of these games where, you know, it's a 3-point game, one possession game in the fourth, and Kansas City goes on like some crazy run on like 5 minutes where they get two touchdowns and it makes it look like a bigger blowout than it was.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't see them being that big of an underdog. I think that's maybe a little prisoner of the moment.
Let me ask you this. Do you expect the Browns to come out and run the ball a lot? Because, you know, you see a lot of people saying like, oh, Kansas City's susceptible to giving up yards on the ground. Their run defense is mediocre at best, and the Browns have a great running game. Or do you expect them to the Browns? I mean, do you expect them to come out throwing more?
On paper, my gut says that conventional wisdom would say they need to come out, run the ball, slow the game down, limit the number of possessions. But we've seen them this year a couple times where we go into a game and that's what we're thinking we should expect them to see. And then they come out early throwing a lot and have a lot of success with it. I think we saw it against Tennessee and a couple other times. I'll put it this way. Neither one would surprise me. I do think they need to have an effective run game. And I do think they need to sort of limit the number of possessions. I don't think you want to go blow for blow with Kansas City. I don't think you want a shootout, but I don't necessarily think that means they need to be, you know, running on first and second down every single time, getting, you know, 4 yards a clip and putting themselves in third down situations. I think that's risky too. I think conventional wisdom would say that, but I don't know that this is a conventional team.
I'm not sure a shootout is avoidable, if I'm being honest. The Browns defense they've been getting a little bit better, and it's certainly going to help, hopefully, with having Denzel Ward back and, you know, getting as close to having a healthy defense as they've had in a while. You know, we'll see what he can do. I don't know that we know a whole lot about just how much he was impacted by COVID. You know, we've seen what it did to Myles Garrett down the stretch of the season this year. But I mean, the Browns are going to give up points. Kansas City is going to score points, and you know, the Browns are going to put up points as well. So the one other thing I will say in terms of, you know, are the Browns going to be run heavy or pass heavy? I think the important thing for the Browns above all else offensively is to just get the ball into the hands of your best players. And, you know, regardless of how that has to happen, you know, get the ball in Jarvis Landry's hands, get the ball in the hands of, you know, Nick Chubb and Kareem Hunt. And whether it's running the ball, or, you know, it's setting up screen passes. I mean, the Browns absolutely broke the Steelers' backs with a couple of passes to their running backs. You know, the Kareem Hunt second touchdown and or was it the first one? I don't know. They were real similar parts of the field. But you know the one I'm talking about. Yeah. The screen to Kareem, and then the Browns' last touchdown was that pass over the middle to Chubb. So, you know, there's other creative ways, and, you know, if there's one thing we know about Kevin Stefanski, it's that he can get creative with his scheming. So, I'll be real interested to see how the Browns approach that. Cause, it could get pretty fun.
Yeah, for sure. I think, and this will sound this might be a bad omen and a bad thing to bring up, but in a way, it sort of feels like, part of me feels like it has some similarities to the Ohio State-Alabama game, which obviously did not go well. They came out flat. I think you absolutely cannot afford that. You cannot afford to come out, you know, quick three and out and then give up a touchdown right after. You don't want to be playing catch up. But I don't necessarily think that means you need to run like a ball control type plotting offense all game either. I think you need to do the things that you're comfortable with, and you need to go out there and try to score points every time. And I think it'll be big. One thing I think, and I felt this way Monday when I was watching Ohio State and Alabama, if you get down in the red zone, you can't settle for field goals. You need touchdowns. I think that's going to be huge. And we saw them struggle a little bit with that last week against Pittsburgh, even when they were up big. That was later in the game, obviously, and they were sort of, I don't know, they were in more of a run clock type offense. So maybe they were playing a little bit safe, but you're not going to beat Kansas City kicking field goals. And so they need to execute all 100, the entire length of the field, and they need to come out strong. They can't afford to come out slow. But if they do that, I think they have a pretty damn good shot.
Nothing to lose here. You know,
they won't say it, but I think it was Baker. They asked him that. I said, does it feel like you're kind of playing with house money? He'll say no. Thankfully, we wouldn't want him to say yes. But I think for most people, you'll say, yeah, if you can come out and look, you know, look strong, look respectable, put a good performance out on the field, you can walk away with your head held high, win or lose.
Yeah,
I feel like I said that last week too, and it bit me in the ass. So hopefully same result.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was one of those things last week where I felt like, you know, I hate using the phrase the national media, but a lot of reporters from the networks.
Lamestream media.
God. Awful. There was a kind of a tone in the approach to the Browns of like, oh, you know, what a nice story. The Browns have made the playoffs. Like, this is your big moment. And you know, we're going to tell all your stories now because none of us expect you to still be here next week. You know, the Browns still are. So here we go. We'll see what happens.
Hey there, and welcome to the Joy of Paddle podcast, hosted by me, Minter Dial, a veteran of the paddle tennis world, and sponsored by Paddle 1969. Whether you're a paddle tennis aficionado, just beginning, or have never even heard of paddle, or padel, as it's called in North America, this is an exhilarating new show that delves into the captivating stories of notable paddle personalities worldwide. In its inaugural season, you'll be treated to exclusive anecdotes, valuable tips, life lessons, and humorous moments shared by esteemed professional paddle players, industry insiders, and passionate paddle enthusiasts. With each season aligning with the Pro Tour, you can anticipate 2 engaging episodes per month. The Joy of Paddle podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network, where you can find other great shows in a number of categories, such as sports, health and wellness, true crime, and fiction. To find out more about Evergreen Podcasts, go to www.evergreenpodcast.com. Vamos!
Hey, let me ask you this. Just kind of getting around the rest of... How much of the rest of the wild card weekend did you catch? Were you watching any of the other games? Anything else jump out at you?
I watched a pretty fair amount. I watched most of the Baltimore-Tennessee game. It was a close game, but like I mentioned, I thought both teams played to lose. I was kind of embarrassed for both of them, honestly. I watched the who did the Saints play? Why am I blanking?
The Bears.
Yeah, I watched that game. That game was dog shit, but.
Well, let me ask you.
I liked the Nickelodeon aspect.
Yes, that's what I wanted to ask you about. Did you watch the Nickelodeon broadcast?
Get Nickelodeon. I don't have cable, so I watch all of my games on an app, and the Nickelodeon app does not have live TV. So, no, I did not watch it on there, but I saw like some of the clips and stuff, and I love the idea. Like, I love the concept. I thought the end zone slime was pretty cool. Like, a lot. And from what I can tell in the clips that I did see, it seemed like that for like a first effort, it was a pretty damn good job.
You're going to see a lot more of these types of broadcasts, I think, with the other sports, because it did very well, got a lot of praise. I think it drew like 2 million viewers, which is a great number considering the game was on a major network as well. You know, the announcers, I thought, I mean, they were obviously, Gary, you know, there was a lot of explanation, like a touchdown's worth 6 points, a field goal's worth 3 points. And you know, they had the actor that plays young Sheldon popping up on the screen as like their rules analyst or whatever, like explaining penalties and stuff.
I can't stand that kid. I feel bad saying it because he's probably like 12 years old, but God,
he's well paid. Yeah, don't worry about
fucking
it.
Fucking obnoxious. Like, they used to have him do like guests. They had him doing like video clues on Jeopardy, and I just wanted to punch him in the face.
Oh no. I will say this though. Everybody just, you know, all the talk about this was that it was going to be geared towards like 7 year olds or, you know, young kids. And in a lot of ways it was. Like, my daughter loves playing Roblox. We have to like set limits on, you know, time limits on her tablet, so she's not playing Roblox for 4 hours a day or whatever. Well, they did like replay sequences where they recreated plays using Roblox. And I was like, oh, maybe this will get her interested in watching football a little bit. And so I showed her. I'm like, hey, check this out. It's Roblox. She's like, oh, that's cool.
And then
I'm like, oh, yeah, you want to watch it for a minute? No.
No,
but like, I think as much as that broadcast was geared towards young kids, I think there was also a push to try to appeal to people in like the 25 to 35 age bracket, as weird as that sounds. If you listened to a lot of like the Nickelodeon shows they were referencing and just kind of the things that they were dropping in there, Nate Burleson did an awesome job with this. They were not shows that are like on Nickelodeon now. It was the stuff that people were watching on Nickelodeon like 15 or 20 years ago.
Yeah, I heard someone, I heard at one point they compared, I think, Michael Thomas and Alvin Kamara to Kenan and Kel. It's like, Kenan and Kel's been on SNL for like 10 years, or Kenan's been on SNL for like 10 years now. Kids these days are not watching him on this channel.
I saw the woman who was the referee on, what was that show, Guts?
Mo?
Did you? Quirk? Yes.
What?
She was not on the broadcast, but I did see... Somebody retweeted her. She popped up on social media talking about it. She's like, I got to go find my original whistle from when I was working on Guts. And she actually talked about it and stuff like that. So, yeah, because there was like a bad call or something. People are like, we need to get Mo out there. And it's like, oh, hey, I'm here. What's up?
That's a fantastic call. I love Mo.
Yeah.
Mike O'Malley wasn't available, I guess.
No, probably not. But Ian Eagle's son, Noah, was the one who did the play-by-play for this. And if you just listen to his voice, you'd think it was his dad. It's uncanny how similar they sound.
I've heard that.
But mark my words, like 25 years from now, he's going to be calling a Super Bowl for one of the major networks. And when he does, you can guarantee that they're going to set up a video clip. Hey, do you remember the first time you ever called an NFL playoff game? And it's going to be showing him and slime cannons going off in the end zone.
Yeah, I think I've heard him. I've heard that he's pretty damn good actually at it.
Yeah, he did great.
Collinsworth's kid, whatever. but I don't want to get into that too much. But yeah, I think for a concept, it's interesting. And honestly, it feels like one of those things that I can't believe no one's done earlier or no one sooner. Right. Like, how long have we been hearing about how baseball needs to get young kids actually interested in baseball? And they've never thought to do anything like this before. I'm glad it worked out. Like, I'm glad it sounds like for all intents and purposes, it was as good as they could have expected it to go.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's especially because like mega casts are kind of becoming the new thing. I mean, ESPN did that with the Titans Ravens game they had, you know, the main broadcast on one channel, and then I think they did a coach's room, and they do with the college football playoff where they blow it out and have the game being broadcast on seven different channels. I mean, like, why not throw a feed on there that has, you know, something for kids? I mean, you could probably do that with like other niche audiences as well. So it's fun.
More into like the business aspect, I think, and like, but particularly when it comes to like TV and broadcasting rights, how does that play out? Like, I don't remember what network had it, but do they like
CBS? So that was actually, I think, that was kind of a big reason I think they actually got that, because like all the contracts for the, you know, playoff games, you know, the TV deals, those had been signed years ago. Well, the NFL this year had, you know, they expanded the playoffs. So for the first round, there were two extra games that were not covered by the existing contracts. So they put those games up for bid, and all their broadcast partners, they're like, hey, we're going to give you all the opportunity to bid on these two extra games. And NBC got an extra one, and CBS got an extra one. And that's why like those games were specifically, you know, 'cause everybody's like, well, wait a minute, why is this NFC game on CBS? It should be, you know, on Fox. And it's because that game wasn't part of the contract that Fox has to broadcast all the NFC playoff games. It was a whole separate deal, which was kind of confusing. And I don't think that was entirely spelled out ahead of time, but you know, once they set the schedule for last week, and that was why. And CBS and Nickelodeon and a whole bunch of other channels on cable are all part of Viacom. So, you know, when CBS has a game, they can, you know, do things like that with Nickelodeon, that they're all under the same umbrella. Same thing with like ESPN and ABC and Freeform, which used to be ABC Family, or, you know, NBC's got their whole, you know, suite of cable channels as well. If they ever want to do a mega cast, they, you know, like they do stuff with like USA Network and NBC Sports Network and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think, I feel like the widespread use of like apps and stuff now too to watch TV, like how much stuff is streaming, it kind of covers their ass, right? So if you're a parent and you're like used to just throwing on Nickelodeon for your kid, and you turn it on and it's football, you're not going to be that mad because you're like, oh shit, oh whatever, I'll just put the app on. There's something on there I can put on, right? There's so much other access to that programming. While in the past, if all you had was Nickelodeon and you turn on Nickelodeon, it was an NFL game, you're like, what the shit? What am I supposed to do with this, right? So I think that kind of covers their ass in terms of giving them, you know, an out to say that, you know, we're going to try this thing and see how it goes. But yeah, it's kind of cool that it sounds like it was generally a success. And I think you're right. I think we should probably expect to see quite a bit more of it.
Yeah. You wanted to do a quick postmortem on the Buckeyes. I don't have a ton to say about that game. I can tell you the interest level and excitement level, especially coming after, you know, 24 hours after the Browns, it was hard to get back up and as excited again like we were the night before. Our texting chain with John was not nearly what it was the night before, and largely got stifled, I think, by the way that game played out. But give me your synopsis on the Buckeyes. Yeah,
judging by the ratings, we were not alone in that. I don't know. It's one of those games where you knew you were kind of walking into a buzzsaw. And I think talent-wise, Ohio State can match up with anyone. But you have to execute from the opening snap to, you know, you got to go all 60 minutes. And Ohio State just had a couple sections there, or a couple parts of the game where they just couldn't really get much going. And at one point, Tough Borland was left with the task of covering Devontae Smith, and you knew like, okay, something here went terribly wrong.
A tragedy is about to unfold.
Something not good is going to happen here. And I don't know. I'm giving a lot of people sort of benefit of the doubt because like a guy like Sean Wade, who came in this year as a first round draft pick, hopeful, was switched to an outside corner position without a full off season. And so I guess, like I said, I'm giving some guys benefit of the doubt, but there were, I don't know that I've ever watched an Ohio State game where there were so many plays that the moment they snapped the ball, I knew, yeah, we fucked up here. They're going to score a touchdown. Like, you could watch it unfold, and it felt like we were moving in slow motion, getting to, like, spots. And it was frustrating. I'm honestly not too terribly upset about it because, all things considered, I'm really glad we got to see an Ohio State season at all. And they murdered Dabo Swinney last week, so I'll take that, and I'll be able to enjoy that forever. But Alabama just – they did what they seemed to do quite a bit. And, it was a bummer of a game to watch, but I'm not too, like, heartbroken about it, honestly.
The best team won. Alabama had the best team. I don't think the final score was necessarily indicative.
The gap's not as big as the score makes it look, but they deserve to win. And if they played again, Bama probably wins 7 of them. And there's no shame in that. You know, being it raises the question of, and they talked about this quite a bit on the broadcast, and I think I probably looked at it a little bit differently than they did. They were talking about Jaylen Waddle, who I fucking think it was wildly irresponsible to have let him play that game.
He was like limping around the field.
First fucking play, he catches a ball and he hobbles back to the sideline, and Herb Street and Fowler on the broadcast talking about how, it's just different at Alabama. That's one of the things that they do so well is guys buy in and they're going to leave it all out there for Alabama. I'm like, that's not like an endearing quality. Like, this is irresponsible.
Are they leaving NFL money out there? Is that what they're leaving out there?
With this kid's future to win a national title at Alabama that he's already got one. Oh, actually, I don't know if he was a senior, so I don't know if he was there the year they won it, but he might be a junior. I'm not positive, but I look at it and it's like, this isn't something to celebrate. I understand it's college football and it's nowhere near the amateur sport that a lot of people want to pretend it is, but that was very clearly, in my opinion, risking his future for a game that, quite frankly, he wasn't even really effective in. Like, he wasn't giving you a whole lot when he was on the field anyways.
They did not need him.
And
there
I'll be honest, they won that game and they put a lot of kids in the pros. I think it's one of the things you look at. I think there's a reason a lot of those Alabama guys break down early. They're early round draft picks and they never really contribute that much because they got the shit kicked out of themselves in practice every day at Alabama for 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, if you wanted to get him on the field for like a ceremonial type snap towards the end in a low leverage situation, maybe.
And they had that they had the center go out there and snap the ball. And part of me, I was like, you know what? Fuck these guys. Hit this kid as hard as you can. But then I'm like, let's not do that either. Like, part of me was like, let's not hurt this fucking kid just because you wanted to get him a snap. And I look at like, if I was a parent and my kid was a top, that to me says, yeah, you'll win a national title, but at what cost do I want to risk my kid's future for that? I don't know. Obviously,
you gotta secure the bag.
Obviously, it doesn't matter. But, I don't know. That's not really the focus of the game, right? I think you look at Devontae Smith, arguably the best season from a wide receiver we've ever seen. Which is funny because last year, I think you can make the case that Joe Burrow had the best season from a quarterback we've ever seen. This year was obviously pretty weird, right? It was shortened and all this other stuff. It's kind of crazy to think about it. If Jaylen Waddle doesn't get hurt, what is Devontae Smith anywhere near what he was?
That's great.
Like, Jaylen Waddle was the number one receiver before he got hurt. So, yeah. I mean, Alabama's got a lot of storylines, and you know, it's Alabama. They do it every other year. They win a title, and you know, they'll just keep humming along. Hopefully, fucking Saban hangs him up soon enough. Get the hell out of the way, but.
Enough already. Seriously. You've made your
point.
You
know what else I was thinking about? What a crazy what if. What if Saban never left LSU? Is LSU what Alabama is? Or is he just, you know, like a decent coach who wins maybe one or two more titles?
Well, I mean, he won one.
Yeah, he won one in 03 there. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you could certainly see a scenario where he builds up the same kind of a dynasty there. I mean, he was already on his way before he cut that short to go try the NFL for a while.
Yes. It's one of those crazy with us. I mean, we don't need to talk about it too much. It's just one of those things. I think about all these different things, and I think that's just kind of how sports is, right? If one little thing goes a little bit differently, everything changes. Sure.
Yeah. The butterfly effect. Exactly. I tell you know, it was cool that Ohio State made the national championship game, but this college football season was just not very fun.
Oh, I mean,
like, other than the Sugar Bowl was great. Don't get me wrong. That was one of the most fun college games I can remember watching, probably since Ohio State beat Alabama in the Sugar Bowl. Yeah. Was that 6 or 7 years ago? Yeah. But like, other than that, like, this entire season, like, how many games are you really going to remember from the season? Like, I mean, like, everything about it, like, all the storylines, like, and we talked last week about the Heisman, like, there was no, like, talk of, you know, the Heisman Trophy all year. It finally got to, like, you know, the end of the season. It was like, oh, yeah, wait, we're a few days before the national championship game and they still haven't handed out the Heisman. That's right. They probably should get around to doing that. But like, just like games that you're really going to think about from this year.
I will think of Clemson for a long time. That'll be one of those games that I remember.
Obviously, right. But
win
like from
taken out because they didn't win the next game. But
there's two games from the regular season that I'll remember. And one of them was the Notre Dame Clemson game at Notre Dame when Notre Dame won. And Trevor Lawrence wasn't playing. That was a fantastic game. And the only other one that really stands out to me was the game between Coastal Carolina and BYU, because those were two teams that were like on the periphery trying to, like, you know, break through the glass ceiling.
And it was like scraped together on a Thursday.
Had a last minute opening and put that game together on 2 days' notice and ended up having like one of the best games of the year. And I thought that was really cool. And ultimately, it like didn't really benefit either one of them.
Yeah, it's
which is a shame. They deserve to get some credit for doing that, and especially Coastal for winning. Yeah, like this season, just everything about it was like
it just never really got going. Like it felt like every time you got to a point where it's like, all right, now we're finally there. Another game would get canceled, or another guy would go out with COVID or whatever it was, right? So
it's kind of off the field. It's
a 2020 football season.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we should be glad that we got any kind of college football at all, but like everything about it was just like, can this game be played? No, does this team have enough games to be eligible for their conference title? And it was all just like procedural and health related things and not about actual like teams and games and, you know, the fun stuff that you actually watch football for. So, I'm very much at peace with this college football season being over. I look forward to next year, when I'm not like cringing at seeing more than 20,000 people in the stands and we actually hear marching bands again. I miss the atmosphere of that. It's one of my favorite parts
of
like
college football. You know, does better than anybody else.
Yes. Yeah. The atmosphere of college football games is fantastic. And it didn't have it this year. No, and that sucks, but it is what it is.
It's interesting you mention that because I think that's incredibly noticeable during college games. I'm with you. Like the ceremonial shit and all the pomp and circumstance that goes along with college football is a huge part of what makes college football. I don't think it matters in the NFL. I don't think the NFL game has suffered all that much.
No, it's definitely not as noticeable.
I got used to it pretty quick.
The one thing I did notice was the dubbed in booing and cheering during the Rams Seahawks game on Fox. Like they've had an entire season to work on this, and it sounded so like it was comically bad how like fake it sounded. I'm glad that Fox at least bailed on having the CGI fans in the stands. That was a terrible look. And they were so excited about that when they announced it over the summer, like, this is going to be the future. And it's like,
I will admit that was one of my favorite things about the early baseball season. Cause like 3 to 4 times a game, you'd see like a foul ball get drilled in the stands. You're like, that fake person is dead right now. It's just like a fucking rocket and nobody reacts whatsoever. And it just goes right through the guy's head. But it also kind of reinforces how important the Nets are. So,
well, there you go. Yeah, this was supposed to be the first year for the baseball Nets too. And, I guess the CGI fans were protected, but most of them anyway.
Yeah.
Speaking of TV things.
I want to get your opinion on Urban to Jacksonville. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but how do you think that?
Oh, you mean our fellow member of the Evergreen Podcasting Network?
Yeah, the same.
I wish him a lot of luck.
Do you think it works or no?
No.
You think it's a failure or you think it's like Bill O'Brien?
Because
people love one of the things I noticed, people love shitting on Bill O'Brien like he was a complete failure. He won his division 4 times in 6 years and like won a couple playoff games. Like, they were not the disaster that everybody makes them out to be. Now, there's obviously a lot of like organizational dysfunction and stuff there, but now
he did not leave a very good situation for his successor. Diminishing returns there, and it was time for him to go. As for Urban, I'll be very interested to see what kind of a staff he can put together. I just don't. I mean, if
he wants Kerry Coombs, I'm okay with that.
You're not the only Ohio State fan I know who said that. I don't know. Just, he's been out of coaching for a few years. He's never been in the NFL. And I just feel like with the way he's wired and, he's had like health issues that have, taken him out of very good college jobs. I just don't know how that's going to translate.
I'll just close up on this. I think the one thing that will be kind of unique is people always talk about how he's sort of like, he's kind of a maniac. And I think it's one of the things that separate him and Saban and a couple other guys from pretty much everyone else in college is their 24/7 psychotic approach to getting every little detail right. And you can look at it and say like, well, it's the NFL, it's a higher level, the pressure's higher. I don't think the pressure at Jacksonville is as high as it is at Ohio State. Losing 2 games at Ohio State is a failure of a season. He's going to have much more leeway. Whether he allows himself to have that leeway will tell, right? But it'll be interesting to see him in a position where he's able to coach where there is absolutely zero buffer or room for error whatsoever. I don't know. I hope it works out for him. I'm kind of glad that his wife is going to get the hell out of Ohio, but beyond that, I'll put it this way. I'm very grateful for everything Urban Meyer did for Ohio State, and I like Urban Meyer, but I'm happier with Ryan Day. So I'm happy with where we are. I have no hard feelings towards Urban whatsoever. I hope he has a whole lot of success there, but I don't miss him.
Well, he goes and coaches down in Jacksonville. If things don't work out with the Jaguars, maybe he can like go next door to their stadium and go manage the inner circle with Chris Jericho and All Elite Wrestling. Because
can you imagine if they do like cross promotion there?
Well, they do. I mean, the Khan family that owns the Jaguars
is the one that does AEW, right?
AEW, yeah, and. They've been, with the pandemic going on and them not being able to, tour the country in arenas, they've been doing all of their shows out of the amphitheater that's next door to the Jaguars Stadium. It's a, setup that looks very similar to like Nautica, Jacobs Pavilion, whatever they call it now here. So, yeah, maybe he can go hang out and, manage some wrestlers or something. Yeah. That'd be fun.
It's an interesting fit, I think. And I don't know that I ever got the feeling when everyone was in college, I don't know that I ever got the feeling that he was a guy who really wanted to coach in the NFL. So I thought this was kind of an interesting move from him, but see what happens. It'll be fun to watch.
Yeah, I'm surprised. I didn't think he was done coaching, but I always assumed he was going to go take another high profile college job somewhere else.
Yeah, I thought he probably had one more stop in him.
Yeah.
And if this is it, okay, good. I don't have to worry about him poaching recruits and stuff.
Right. Yeah. Hey, one more thing before we get out of here. I need your 2-minute take on Ken Jennings as the first guest host of Jeopardy.
I was really impressed with him, honestly. I thought he's been really good. I think I will say this. It's one of the things, the only complaint that I will ever lodge against Alex Trebek is he sometimes moved a little slow reading clues and stuff. And I've noticed over the last few years, more rounds were left with a couple clues on the board. He moves a lot quicker, gets through them much quicker. And so those don't happen. They haven't happened yet. I didn't get to watch today because for some reason CBS was showing a Joe Biden speech. So I didn't see today's episode, but I've been impressed with him. It's funny because the first episode, he like did his little monologue thing at the beginning. I was like, this is going to be weird. And it sort of dawned on me how this isn't an easy job. I don't think it's an easy, like, if you look at every other like game show, I think it's pretty, you can kind of just cruise and you don't really need to move at a certain pace and you can screw up and it doesn't matter. You don't have that sort of buffer, I think, on Jeopardy. You need to be on top of it. And I think for the most part, he has been. He's a little chattier probably, but I think a lot of that is nerves. And I noticed just as he went on, he got more comfortable. And I'll be surprised if anyone's better. I saw Aaron Rodgers is going to do it, which is a bizarre choice to me. I don't know. Maybe he's just a huge Jeopardy fan. I don't know how that ever got pulled.
I guess he was on the Celebrity Jeopardy a few years ago. He was a celebrity contestant, but
I guess that also sort of puts to rest the idea that all of these people are actually like auditioning for the job.
Oh yeah, no, this is going to be. I'm wondering like when that's actually going to happen because they.
James is doing it for a full month, I think, isn't he?
Oh, is he really?
I think I saw 30 episodes, which I guess is more than a month if you count.
Yeah, that's 6 weeks.
So, I don't know. So far, I'll be kind of surprised if anyone's better than Jennings. Honestly, he's been really good. He's got a little bit. He doesn't just seem like he's trying to do it the way Alex did it, but he's doing very well. Yeah. So
that was the big thing when Drew Carey took over The Price is Right for Bob Barker, and it was a little different because, Bob Barker just retired. Bob Barker, knock on wood, is still with us. The thing that, Drew Carey, when he was like trying to find his footing with The Price is Right, the biggest thing for him was,
you're not going
to
be Bob Barker.
Don't try to go up there and do a Bob Barker impression because that's not going to work. And it's actually interesting that you said the one thing with Ken Jennings was that he was a little bit chattier. Over the summer when they ran out of new episodes during the pandemic and they had to start, airing reruns, one of them that they showed was Trebek's first ever episode from like 84. And he did the exact same thing. The first episode, like those early episodes that he was doing, he was a lot chattier than once he got into the rhythm of doing it a lot more in later years. So I don't know. Maybe if Ken Jennings gets the job permanently, then maybe that would be something to happen for him as well. But yeah, I'm really interested to see now who else they get to be a guest host and how long they play this out before they name somebody as a permanent successor. Because like you said, they're clearly opening this up now to not just people who are auditioning to be a full-time
replacement. They don't want to rush into it.
Yeah, so we got Ken Jennings for a while. I think Katie Couric's doing a week. Aaron Rodgers is going to do a week.
60 Minutes person whose name I didn't recognize, but he's doing it too. I'll say this. The one thing that it's kind of a weird like subconscious thing is I'm watching Ken Jennings do it. Anytime none of the three contestants know the answer, my first reaction is, well, Ken, did you know that? And he's up there like reading it out. He can't obviously like do it. But he, and when I say chatty, the thing that he does is like, they'll say, you know, someone's last name, and he'll be like, yes, that's right. And he'll say like their full name afterwards.
Full
to, like,
name.
Just show
yeah.
that.
I'm, yeah, we know, Ken. You're real, Ken, you're smart. Yeah.
We get it, Ken. Yeah. We know.
Yeah. So anybody you'd like to see as a guest host?
I think when I looked at the odds, the one that sort of jumped out at me the most, who isn't Ken Jennings. Ken Jennings, I think, is far and away the most natural choice for it. But one I saw that made a lot of sense was Neil Patrick Harris. I could see him doing it, putting his own kind of spin on it, and being really good at it. But as far as people I want to see, not really. I just want to see people that are decent at it. I don't want it to turn into like a sideshow. I don't want to turn it to turn into like I'm nervous Aaron Rodgers is going to be fucking terrible at it. And I'm going to waste time watching him like stumble through an episode. Alex was so good at this that yeah. like I've come to expect it running like a well-oiled machine. I do not want to suffer through bad episodes.
Yeah, the other thing with that is, you know, for us, the viewer at home, okay, you get a week of bad episodes. It is what it is. But, like, if you actually are a contestant on yeah. there and you've spent your yeah. whole life, like, building up to this moment to get your chance and, like, your chance at Jeopardy to actually, like, play on the show is a train wreck because the host yeah. is, you know, somebody doing this for a joke, basically. And I'm not saying that that's what Aaron Rodgers is doing, but like,
right.
you
yeah,
know,
I'm just using him because somebody he's like the most off the wall pick I've seen. But yeah, you're right. I mean, if you go on Wheel of Fortune and like Pat Sajak fucks up and says, oh no, you didn't get this letter. Oh wait. Yeah, you did. There's no harm done. Like,
and we'll never know on television because that'll be edited
right,
out.
Exactly. But in Jeopardy, like if they mess up, they have to come back and Alex, it happened every once in a while. Like he wasn't perfect. But it rarely changed, like, really changed the game much. I think the way that the game moves, it's at a very rapid pace. And I feel like the host needs to know all the answers to every question before the game. They can't be, like, reading,
oh,
they can't be reading it all off of a card. And so you need to have
a. Oh, I'm sure I'm sure that goes.
I think you need to have a damn good memory and know most of that stuff already, which I think is why Ken Jennings works. Because he knows 90% of it without the prep that the other people are going to need.
So since you mentioned the betting odds on this, I had to go and look them up, and I'm going to just tell you right now that some of these would be really interesting.
There were a few I remember that were pretty funny.
Some of them, if you actually wager real American dollars on this, you're lighting money on
give
fire.
Give it to me. I'll give you twice the odds.
Yeah, Joe Rogan is not going to be the new host of Jeopardy.
I will stop watching.
who else do we have on here that could be? I can't imagine Steve Harvey's going to give up his gig with Family Feud. Pat Sajak, no.
Yeah, like he's going to leave America's Game. I can't.
Wheel of Fortune stinks. I'm sorry.
Fucking idiots. It's so stupid.
I've caught myself watching like the last 10 minutes of it a few times.
Yeah, when you're waiting for Jeopardy. Yeah.
For Jeopardy. And, yeah,
exactly.
It stinks.
I wish Jeopardy was on at 7 so that I could not have to suffer through the Wheel of Fortune. My wife
blew my mind to find out that, I found out years ago that that is actually how it works in other cities.
Yeah, in Columbus,
that is
that
not.
Way.
Yeah, I had no clue until like I moved out of Cleveland for a while that actually happens.
You want to know my favorite? I just looked up the odds again. My favorite with odds, Rosie Perez. Every episode has to have foods with Q.
Perfect.
Jon Stewart would probably be decent too.
Yeah, I
could
see
that working out. Okay.
Yeah. Drew Carey's not jumping.
No, I don't know why they have so many like other game show hosts. The thing about Jeopardy, unlike any other, and we'll just close with this. The thing about a Jeopardy host above any other game show by far is they need to be a good like contestant on the show. They need to be someone who, if they were on the show, would do well. Part of Alex's like success was the fact that you felt like he actually knew most of those answers. He was very well read. He was very intelligent. Like if he was a contestant on Jeopardy, he would do very well. He's not counting on, you know, the writers and all this stuff to prepare them for the questions and stuff. Right. He knows most of it already. And if you gave him all of these questions, he'd know most of the answers without you telling him. I think it's kind of like karaoke. If you're going up to do karaoke and you're expecting to read all the lyrics on the screen and you don't know the lyrics, you're going to suck at it.
Pretty much.
I think it's one of the things whenever I like go to a bar and I see people doing karaoke and I see the guy like holding the microphone back like this, like reading off the screen, it's like, you're going to sound terrible. Pick a song you know the words to. Like, what are you doing here?
Or you could be like me and know all the words and still sound terrible.
Oh, yeah, but that's a whole different matter altogether.
It is what it is. Well, hey, what do you know? We said this was going to be a nice quick episode tonight. And here we are over an hour yet again. So I think it's time to close up shop. What do you say? All right. We are on Apple Podcasts. We are on Spotify. You can stream us on waitingfornextyear.com. And of course, we are part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. You can check us out on Evergreen's website as well. That's going to do it for us for this week. For Travis Yulee, I'm Tom Valentino. It's been the Nail in the Coffin. Catch you again soon.
What was it like to be there for historical sports moments and unforgettable performances? To be behind the scenes? On PressBox Access, you'll hear from me, Todd Jones, and other sports writers about their experiences with the greatest athletes, coaches, and sports events of the past half century. We'll share some stories behind the stories, some big, some small, and some we've only told each other. Let us buy you a round on PressBox Access.